Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Kane and Rince podcast, volume 13, issue 608. And today we're going to be talking about Bruce Lee, the computer game. It's not called that, I'm just specifying. Anyway, joining me, Leon Cox, in this issue, are Chris O'Regan.
Hello.
And Jesse Fuchs.
Hi.
That's not bad,
not
actually.
Bad.
I've been practicing for like 40 years, so, you know.
It's more like...
It depends on the system. We'll get to it.
Depends which version you're playing, so. Exactly. Yeah. That actually did bring it all back.
There you go.
So, for those who don't know, Bruce Lee is a 40-year-old 8-bit 2D platformer starring the eponymous martial arts movie legend. Not to be confused with, there have been a few other Bruce Lee games. There was, of course, Dragon, the Bruce Lee story based or a movie tie-in, if I recall correctly. That was Jaguar, Game Gear, Master System and Mega Drive, Genesis and Super Nintendo in the mid-90s. Since then, we've had Bruce Lee Quest for the Dragon on the Xbox, which was less well received, 2002. Bruce Lee Return of the Legend, slightly better received on the GBA 2003, although I have very little memory of it. And most recently was Bruce Lee Dragon Warrior, no longer available, but was an iOS and possibly Android game from around 2011 that was also surprisingly well regarded and is now a victim of the industry's inability to preserve its own legacy. But there you go. We're talking about a 1984 computer game. Handily, we have two industry computer game veteran experts with us, starting with Jesse. I don't know if you played this one back in day, but
no, this is a key.
You did say 40 years. Yeah,
childhood game that I cover maybe more than
perfect.
It deserves. Although, you know, we'll get into it. It's a very good game, and I think it's held up incredibly well. But it is a key game in that American 80s computer games class, even though, you know, and I have it under multiplayer. To spice it up. I mean, it could go, a lot of things could be like action, like Load Runner could go in action or construction, you know, Archon could be action or multiplayer. I put Bruce Lee in multiplayer because I do think you get to control the green Yamo and just, you know, harass the other person is an incredibly important part of this game that, like many things, reminds me of Dark Souls, and we'll get into that.
Wow. I was not expecting the inevitable Dark Souls.
Yeah, no, I promise this is
We're
not...
3 minutes in, everyone. 3 minutes in.
Lots of boss baby vibes. I have an argument.
Crack those bottles open.
I have a multi-layered argument, I promise.
I love it. So not only did you play it as a kid, I guess you've been back now and again, both for professional and personal reasons.
Yeah, I hadn't gone through and actually finished the whole thing shamefully as an adult, even though I would teach it, but I would go and, you know, play it for a half. I know the opening area. As I realize, and we'll get into, you know, even from my childhood, I have essentially a asymptotic, like, you know, a geometrically descending memory of this game, because if you die, you go back to the beginning, etc. So I know those first couple of screens incredibly well, and then, you know, as we go through the puzzles. But yeah, no, I was delighted. I even mentioned this, I'll talk momentarily later a little about the very first Kane and Rince related thing I was on, which was Sound of Play. And I think this was the game, this and Space Taxi, I made some joke about, like, well, when you cover that, bring me back.
Okay. Chris, what about yourself?
The first game I ever speed run with a friend or two.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We had the Spectrum version.
Yeah.
And we were Kane and Rincing it back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just got hold of it and went, this isn't Jet Set Willy. That's right. It's not stupidly hard that
you can actually finish it.
You can actually finish it. Yeah. That was the thing. It was just
unusual.
Right. Yeah, very unusual. So we would speed run it. More than, you know, score chase, it was speedrunning.
Yeah.
Amazing. Good times.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we'll talk about versions and conversions later. Obviously, the Spectrum wasn't the original version. You've been playing some of the other versions, and we'll come back to that in a latter section. For me, yes, I bought this on a tape, an original copy. It was a cassette for the Atari 800 XL, which was my machine, and I didn't know much about it. I knew there was a Commodore 64 version. I wasn't that aware of other versions at this point. I would have been about 1986 that I bought it secondhand, probably in the computer game shop that was in Ann Street, Brighton, that I can't remember the name of now, but I used to go there every Saturday morning and see what I could afford, and played it through many, many, many times. Yes, exactly as we were saying, it's a game that lends itself to completion, which was a rare treat in those days. Not all games were designed to be beaten, and some of them literally didn't allow it.
And while unlike you guys, I don't think I beat it over and over, I did beat it, which was very rare for me as a child, and is one reason I was thinking about, there's an interview with, we're doing Loom later, my secret Brian Moriarty history that we'll eventually all cover, and someday that means we get to Wishbringer, his first game, and that is, you know, a quote-unquote children's game, which just means it's actually completable as a text adventure. And it was inspired by, like, the survey Infocom put out about, you know, what games have you played, which are your favorites, which have you completed, and they discovered very few were completed, and those were very consistently listed as the favorites. And it's this fascinating thing that people didn't necessarily figure out. And Bruce Lee does, you know, I don't want to... In that 80s class, I'll have students at the end rank all the games they played as their weekly game as interesting and fun. And the idea being like, let's separate, you know, sort of the academic, what's going on here with, like, would you recommend this to a friend on a weekend? Right. And Bruce Lee does well. Bruce Lee is like a consistent six to eight. Right. And cool. Again, not unlike Space Taxi or some other games. It's definitely one that I nudge. If students are kind of it's clear they're having a week through other classes or, you know, heavy. I'm like, there's always a game or two. And we're like, just play this. You'll have a perfectly good time and be able to write something easy that isn't like a deep analysis or whatever. But just good game. And that is generally, you know, what they come back with.
We should do Space Taxi just so everyone can attempt the speech in the intro.
Oh, God, yeah.
So this was put together by a developer called Datasoft and initially published, at least, I guess, at home by Datasoft. Around the world, it was published by the likes of Birmingham's own US Gold. It was later meant to be re-released on their budget label Americana, but I'm not sure it ever actually did come out. Other labels who published this, depending on your region, would have included Comptique. I'm guessing that's France. Herbe, Spain, maybe? Software, Drosoft, not sure, could be Germany. And Elite Systems, who I think included it on compilations. It was coded by Ronald J. But now, I guess the French would say it Fortier, but as he's American, I'm going to guess he says Fortier? Fortier? Something
probably,
like that.
Yeah.
So he also worked on... what else did he work on? He
did the
latterly worked
Zaxxon
on some Mega Drive stuff. That's right, Atari Zaxxon.
I think the first one he did for Datasoft, he converted Conan, or... Like, Bruce Lee was definitely his baby, and, reading the bits and pieces... it's clear that it was the one that he kind of, you know, tuned and designed and kind of is responsible for that experiential thing we're talking about.
Right. Sure.
Whereas the other ones, I think it was more, you know, he's tuning Zaxxon, so it works on an Atari.
A definite notable credit, as well as converting alternate reality to Commodore 64, is a game we covered when we did a double game issue with Disney's Aladdin, and he was the technical director on the Mega Drive version, which is cool. And he also did some similar technical work, perhaps at a slightly higher level, on Mickey Mania for the Super Nintendo, Genesis, and PlayStation, later Mickey's Wild Adventure. So that's pretty interesting stuff. And the artist is Kelly Day, who worked on a lot of these Datasoft games from this era, the other licensed games that we're going to talk about in a moment, Zorro, The Goonies, and Conan. Previously worked on Zaxxon with Ronald, which was a conversion of an existing Sega coin-op, of course. Also worked on the Puyan conversion. And, Heathcliff Fun with Spelling on the Atari 8-bit. has never been in my collection.
We're covering it next year. That's my pick.
Yeah, it could be. Some of the versions have a little bit of music. Not all of them do. That was by John A. Fitzpatrick. But I think it depends. I think my, I'm pretty sure my cassette version didn't have music. If it did, I can't remember it. It's possible that that was a disc only feature, but yeah, it may, your memories may vary. And the other credit that's listed on Moby Games is for documentation for one Ingrid Holcomb, when people who wrote the manuals used to sometimes get a name check, which is nice. The game originally came out 40 years ago on the Atari 8-bit initially, then C64, Apple II, FM7 and PC88 all that year. In 1985, conversions to Spectrum, MSX, PC Booter and Sharp X1. And the following year, 1986, we got Amstrad CPC and BBC versions, with DOS arriving again the next year, 1987. And there was an iOS version in 2011. They released it onto the AntStream arcade service in 2021, and it's currently still there at the time of recording. And it's going to be re-released again as Lee rather than Bruce Lee, as the name is no longer being paid for. But the game itself is, has been separated from its license as such. And it is a pack-in game on the forthcoming Atari 400 Mini, which is being released next month, March 2024, at the time of recording. I have my pre-order already in. Reviews at the time, Computer Entertainer, a long since departed organ, gave it 9 out of 10. CMVG gave it 35 out of 40. And the Spectrum conversion that Chris enjoyed so much was a crash smash, 91%. Looking at user reviews today, over on the Atari Mania, Atari fan site, it has a lovely 8.6 out of 10. On Lemon 64, the legendary Commodore 64 fan site, it has 8.67 out of 10. The Moby score is 7.7 out of 10. And is rated number one game for Atari 8-bit.
Yeah, I noticed that when you separated it out, the Atari version is better rated. It's like an 8.1, and yeah, it is the number one with ahead of Donkey Kong, Boulder Dash, Ultima 4, and Star Raiders are the top five. So very heady company.
Yeah, we're covering Star Raiders later this year as well, of course.
But only number 117 on Commodore 64. Mm. So that version...
Well, it had a much bigger library.
Right. No, I looked at what was there and it was like, yeah, it was like a 7.5. So it was, you know, slightly lower rated, but obviously just didn't stand out in the same way.
Yeah. I think that's, even as an Atari fan, I think that's reasonable and understandable.
Yeah.
Sales, very hard to come by. It wasn't on...
I found something, right? So at some point, in some fugue state over the last 6 years, I found that Billboard did have a computer game chart from like 84 to 87. And I was able to find, I don't know, 15 of them. So like every couple of months or something. Maybe they only even ran it that often. But it's a top 20.
Yeah.
And it seems very well compiled. And so here's the odd thing. I have the July and December 1984 top 20s, and it's not on there, but it's listed as a re-entry in the March 85 one at number 7, and then it's number 6 in June, then number 10 in August, and then it disappears. But there's not a version in 85 in America that's like the big conversion that could make sense. I mean, Atari clearly, I'm sure it had great saturation of the Atari market. Everyone who had an Atari either bought one or bootlegged it or whatever, but it's obviously going to be the Commodore one, maybe even the Apple one, that gets it in the sales charts. But it makes me wonder if the Commodore one was delayed or it's odd. Mm. But the point is that it did well over here, right? It wasn't huge, but it was clearly had that kind of, I don't know, like a good movie, Gremlins. It sticks around. Back when the mid-80s movies would kind of grow. It feels like one of those.
Yeah. And we should say, a legendary Bruce Lee, born Legion fan, the Hong Kong American martial artist, had already been gone, sadly, for more than a decade by the time this game came out. I don't know what the deal was done with his estate, but Datasoft obviously thought it was worthwhile from a commercial perspective to not just make this an unlicensed game and actually and put, you know, notionally, even though you wouldn't know if it didn't say on the box and have him on the cover art based on the sprite, you wouldn't think, oh yeah, that's clearly That's clearly Bruce Lee. He's about 4 pixels high. The game was also included in the 1986 compilation They Sold a Million, the second volume of which it was, along with Match Point, Match Day and Night Law. Now, Match Day and Night Law were big sellers, no doubt. They were probably pirated considerably more than they sold. But there was kind of a running joke around at the time that the They Sold a Million compilation was named after the collective sales rather than the individual sales of each title. Because there's no way that the home conversion of Match Point sold a million units.
No.
So other licensed games in this sort of oeuvre from the era, possibly sharing code, if not sharing ideas, concepts. We had Conan Hall of Volta, which was by Eric Robinson and Eric Parker.
Yeah, that one, Conan throws a sword boomerang. So it doesn't feel like it's necessarily originally a Conan game. So you do, right. But it's pretty, I played a little of it. I think the rest of these, it is almost surprising that Kelly Day did the graphics for Zorro and the Goonies, because they're so much less fluid, and maybe, Ron Fortier pushed him to, because it's a martial arts game, that it would, but yeah, they look okay, but this one definitely is the most polished of them. But Conan has some interesting ideas. It's, again, this kind of multi-screen, more like each screen is kind of one puzzle. But, I was going to inevitably introduce the term aardvark into this conversation.
Yes, please, yes.
And
you might need to elaborate on that for those who
because
aren't.
Even the originators in ZZAP probably don't even remember it. But at the same time that ZZAP 64 came up with Shmup for Shoot 'em Up, the very successful neologism.
Still going.
They also came up with Aardvark for Arcade Adventure, which has lasted less. But I love it.
We're trying
and
to bring it back.
The thing is it describes a very particular kind of pre-Zelda game that, other than these Datasoft games, I don't really think we had in the U.S. In this, this kind of, it's a multi-screen platform-y, maybe action-adventure. You have Adventure on the 2600, but, like, you don't have Jet Set Willy, you don't have Night Lore, that is oddly a thing that it feels like you get pre-Zelda more in the UK. And it is one thing I'm kind of wondering about, like, your reaction to this. Like, this game...
Nodes of Yezod and Dundurak and Turnanog and games and Heavy on a Magic.
The ultimate side-scrollers.
Go on.
Cauldron, Sacred Armor of Antiriad, and so on and so on.
And so on and so forth.
Whereas when I think of kind of the cutting edge American, like Electronic Arts doesn't have any of those, right? Like Archon and Mule are interesting, but they're not that. Load Runner is great, but it's not that. They're more in kind of the Donkey Kong, Minor 2049er, which is very influential and is kind of at least a Manic Miner, but is not it's Donkey Kong, but there's 10 different screens and they got cool gimmicks, but they're not like spatially, you're not. And I do really recall Bruce Lee as being the pre-Mario, what's kind of the word I'm looking, I'm exploring. It's not an RPG, which is where I would have had that experience otherwise with things like Ultima, but that kind of wow, I wonder what crazy stuff is next,
absolutely.
It does graze the action adventure genre, but I still think it's more of a platformer.
Well, once you finish it, and I think that's the thing, is once you start, of course, but it's not that big, but I remember having that experience in the same way I did with Mario as a kid of like, this game is infinite, or just that kind of because it's mapping out of space. And as we'll get to when I get to my inevitable Dark Souls comparison, what it does with that space does have these interesting looping qualities that make it seem, very coherent in a way that I had not encountered before. At least in, not a text adventure. I would have encountered that in all sorts of other more cerebral games, but not an action game.
The Goonies game was Scott Spanberg with Kelly Day, and that was obviously a tie-in with the Richard Donner family action-adventure movie produced by Chris Columbus and Steven Spielberg, starring a lot of actors who are doing extremely well to this day and still famous now. Now, as I recall, if there was an Atari 8-bit version of the Goonies, it didn't come to the UK.
Now, it's, I think, only Commodore. Yeah. I've only seen it on Commodore. And
that explains it.
It's a good, it's individual basically puzzle screens, and its gimmick is that it's a co-op game, and if you play it two-player, it's kind of like a very primitive, what's the game I'm thinking? The Blizzard, the very early Blizzard game. Lost Vikings.
Lost Vikings,
It's a bit of that, of like, you go over here and you distract them there, and then this person goes there and does this thing. Which, again, like Bruce Lee, wildly original for 1984, I think even pre-Castles of Dr. Creep, which has some of that, but it's not really an action game in the same way. It's in real time, but like, it's not fluid, and you know, the graphics are much less impressive. And Zorro is definitely, which is by James Garin and Kelly Day doing the graphics based on the Zorro. And right in it, I don't know the story behind this data soft, but like, clearly Goonies is a little out, but Conan, Zorro, and Bruce Lee are all these iconic adventure figures, and it kind of, as far as I can tell, is like a worse but more puzzly Bruce Lee.
Yeah, so I played this quite a bit as a kid. I also had the cassette original copy on my Atari, bought secondhand, same story. And I liked it, and I found it really interesting. But, and this is a good example of the kind of game that you were very used to playing back then, was it was so oblique, and that even with, there was at some point I had a guide, a solution, and I still couldn't make it work. I still couldn't work out how to get this object to that location and all this kind of stuff. So it's way more involved than Bruce Lee in that regard, whereas Bruce Lee is an action, you know, platformer with beat 'em up elements and some arcade, as Chris said, arcade adventure adjacent. Zorro was very much, had a little bit of sword play in it, but was, it's interesting because I don't associate the character of Zorro with puzzling as much as I do with Daring Do and swashbuckling. So it was an odd choice, but I liked the atmosphere, and it seemed to have quite a lot going on, but I just found it utterly confusing and never completed it.
That was the same for me. I played it a lot on the Spectrum version, and I just found it fascinating. All these little bits and pieces you had to do. It felt like almost an ultimate player game, like a Night Lord, but that's just as confusing until you figure out what you have to do and go, oh, wait, that's what you have to do. But Zorro, and I felt it was a bit buggy as well. You get stuck in things, and but it had so much promise. It's sort of like a glimpse into what was to be a really good action adventure. It had some really good ideas, just not particularly implemented very well. I wanted to like it more than I did.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I agree. Obviously, this wouldn't apply to the Spectrum version, but the Atari 8-bit version had this very sort of the Atari 800 was the computer at the era with the most colors, but they actually there were some modes that couldn't use that many colors at a time, and I just remember the surface. There was some underground stuff that was more blue and gray, similar to Bruce Lee. The surface was this sort of sun-bleached, pinkish sandstone kind of look, and it did actually convey an atmosphere in a way that not every game was able to, outside of kind of sci-fi stuff where the screen was black and star-spangled and took us away. This actually was a good example of an earlier game that was kind of made a what was based on a real world space feel like something. I don't know if they actually had to license Zorro, or whether he was public domain at that point, or I don't know what the deal would have been. This was like best part of 15 years before Zorro, the Mask of Zorro, at the in the 90s at the cinema, and there hadn't been like a Zorro series since black and white times, I don't think so, which we used to get shown. I don't
on HBO. This actually ties into Bruce Lee pretty well. I don't know what your history is with the actual Bruce Lee movies, but I have realized just how vertiginous my childhood was of like, I never saw a Bruce Lee movie. I saw the movie constantly on HBO, They Call Me Bruce, which was a movie starring a comedian that is basically a parody of all of the Bruce Lee knockoff movies. Right. Name thing.
I do not know it.
There's all these movies apparently after Bruce Lee dies that are like with Bruce Lee, L-I, or other things that are just like, you know, transmogrifiers, you know, the direct, whatever the equivalent would be of a direct-to-video knockoff in the 70s. And then there's this movie that's like a parody of those with a Korean guy who keeps getting mistaken for a martial arts, you know, for Bruce Lee, who looks a little like Bruce Lee, but not really. And like, the movie's commenting on the racism and all that. And like, that's the movie I saw a bunch of times when I was eight, never actually seeing the direct Bruce Lee or just that. Yeah, that sense of, you know, you're only getting the kind of odd little reflection there. What reminded me of this is that the only Zorro movie I saw was Zorro the Gay Blade starring George Hamilton, which is not good, I'm guessing, but it was on HBO a lot when I was a kid, and it was a comedy of some sort. Right. And like, that was my impression of Zorro at that point. And yeah, I mean, I'm just kind of curious, like, had you seen a Bruce Lee movie when you played this, or was he just this like free-floating icon?
That for me, I still don't recall ever honestly having sat down and watched an entire Bruce Lee movie front to back, beginning to end. I've seen a million clips, obviously. I'm very aware of his legendary status, but yeah, I am absolutely not a kind of a devotee or anything. Chris?
My oldest brother, I'm youngest of four, and he loved Bruce Lee. He
was a
huge fan, but he was 9 years older than me, or is nine years older than me. So He remembers him and went to, you know, see films of him and stuff. But I never saw it as a child because young and very violent.
My
parents are quite, you know, sort of strict in that kind of thing. But no, sorry, Kevin can see it, Chris, but you can't. And that's fine. It's fine. He's a grandfather now, so. But
his kids are all watching Bruce Lee.
They are, yeah. But
his grandkids.
But I knew of it, but it just really struck me when we first encountered the game. Like, well, they made a video game about Bruce Lee. Okay. And it, you know, I was expecting something else, but we can talk about that later. But yeah, that's my only sort of cultural link, is my older brother enthusing over his efforts.
Yeah, and I guess, fighting games had started to become a thing at this point. I think it was where the Exploding Fist was probably 85. So this was the year we had, in the arcades, we had Ya Ya Kung Fu, which we're covering later this year, and Kung Fu Master. But home fighting games were not such of a concern in 84, so it kind of made sense that Bruce Lee got a platform action game instead of a versus fighting game or a scrolling beat 'em up, which wasn't really a genre at this point. So, yeah.
Well, the one exception would be Karateka, which is 84.
Was this year. Very good point.
And,
they could have done that.
Yeah, no, it comes out around the same time on the Apple II, and it is, I did notice it being number one on those Billboard charts at least at one point.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Although, again, 84 to 86, is it like, also in, you know, Mechner's Prince of Persia Diary, he's kind of grousing that, man, if I had gotten number one in 82, I'd be a millionaire, but, you know, 84 to 86, number one is like, yeah, you did fine, but it's not the old days, like with Choplifter or whatever. But, yeah, I'm very curious, especially, I wonder if we covered Prince of Persia a while back, and yeah, I've never, Bruce Lee is never mentioned in there, but again, as a somewhat unique, you know, sort of action platformer adventure game for the time, that was, I'm sure, compared to Karateka at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Recommendation for listeners of this podcast, if you haven't already, to check out The Making of Karateka, which is Digital Eclipse's interactive collection of Karateka games with documentaries and interactive, I guess it's like a museum piece.
Yeah, it's like their Atari 40 collection, but even better. Yeah, it's amazing. And to tie into another episode we did, their Jeff Minter one's coming out, I think, next month.
Imminent.
So, yeah.
I know. So soon. Can't wait.
Exciting.
So You also, Jesse, wanted to touch upon this confusion there is, or you have, about two software companies with similar names.
Several years of even teaching that class, much less the 40 before that, I could not keep track of Datasoft versus Datamos, which are two American computer game companies of about the same stature, I would say, sort of that middle level. They had a few hits. Datamos did more also book publishing. And in my class, we covered them for The Billis Toad, which is a fascinatingly violent one-on-one top-down fighting game that shocked people with its half a frame per second, axe murder. and Aztec and Swashbuckler, which are these are very primordial but visionary Apple II games. Both those makers never made commercial games again. John Romero tried to track down the Aztec guy with no success. But what I realized was confusing me is that a game that we covered on the That Sound of Play, Alternate Reality the City, which is a Datasoft game, the folks who made that made Tale of Beta Leary for Datamos before they made Alternate Reality for Datasoft.
Okay.
And that is probably where I just could not keep track of things. And both companies did arcade ports to some extent, but Datamos were the knockoff type and Datasoft were the licenses. So if you, need it, Datasoft was a little more, if you want to rank them against each other, I think, Alternate Reality and Bruce Lee are definitely slicker and more fun games at this point than either Billis Toad or Aztec, which are, nine interesting, three fun, definitely, in their way. And also there is a Ron Fortier who has written a huge number of comics and some novels for TSR, who is a different person. So, but unrelated. It could be the same person. So just make sure ChatGPT doesn't conflate them for you. And I did find
point if you're cheating on your essays.
Ron Fortier on Twitter, is now our Ron Fortier, the Bruce Lee one, is helping 800 dentists, doctors, and local businesses, is the director of Dr. Genius California, whatever that may be. So, he's not in games anymore, but doing something involving something digital.
Okay.
Slight aside, just great to see someone trying to attempt to put Zaxxon on home computers. The best version for me was always the home version was ColecoVision. But that's aside. That was awesome. But anyway.
The soft thing, it gets even more confusing when I recall that my copy of The Tale of Beta Lyre was released in this country, at least by Databyte, to confuse things further.
Oh, God.
So, so if you want to image search The Tale of Beta Lyre, you'll find a load of Databyte copies of that game as well. Amazing music.
Well, one more tangent on, since this is all tangents episode. tangents. The ColecoVision Zaxxon is the best, and R.I.P. Janelle Jackway, who she programmed that and was responsible for most of the ColecoVision boards, which are amazing because they did not give her the source code. Like, it was basically just trying to recreate these arcade games from first principles, which is very impressive.
Zaxxon's still really hard, by the way. Yeah. Now, Capone Adam from our forum has posted saying, "I cannot believe Kanan Rince is devoting an entire episode to Bruce Lee. I thought it was this sacred childhood game that only myself and my sister had ever played. I don't know how or why we even had it. It's not like we were Bruce Lee fans. I recall playing this on a 14-inch Ferguson black and white television. It was quite a haunting game, partly down to its complete lack of music. Even the sound effects were just these really deep sounds of traversal with the occasional high-pitched sound of collecting a lantern. There was no story. I had no idea who the two enemies chasing me were or why they were chasing me. Looking at it now, it comes across more like an elaborate science test for rats than a fun video game for children. The game still comes up from time to time when chatting with my sister. She was the master of this game. We have this special memory because there was this one time where she was on her 7th playthrough in a row. At around the 5th playthrough, my mum started calling her downstairs for a bath. After multiple failed attempts to get my sister in the bath, my mum eventually came storming in and pulled the plug. Yet, in hindsight, I don't recall the game even changing on subsequent playthroughs. It just loops. I genuinely can't wait for this episode to air, as I'm wanting to know as much as possible about this bizarre game." No, I don't think it changes at all. I don't think there's like a loop to
no,
Bruce Lee.
It's not. It's just what just death you are you going to suffer from. There you go.
I think the Green Yamo comes in quicker.
You might be right.
I think that's the new Game Plus features. They basically, there's no pause in them showing up.
No.
Okay. Just,
yeah. Okay.
There you go. Well, that would make a difference. Let's talk about those graphics. I was talking about a 1984 computer game. As I say, I'm infinitely more familiar with the original Atari than any of the other versions. And my recollection was that even for the time, and I was playing them. Now, bear in mind that games used to age more rapidly back then because technology was advancing so quickly and people were kind of getting to grips with stuff. But even in 1985 or whatever, I remember thinking this game didn't look especially sophisticated. It was easy on the eye. It was easy to understand what was going on. The characters had character and a little bit of personality. But in terms of visuals and backdrops, it was all pretty basic, quite grainy looking pixely stuff. The mountains in the backdrops of the above ground stuff were quite crudely rendered. Some castle turrets and crenellations, again, just very simple, lack of colour and all that. But for all that, it didn't bother me. As I say, I completed this game multiple times. I never thought it was like a hideous mess. It was just, it was not one of the games that I would put on to go, look, Mum, look at the graphics on this.
I'm going to have to say that each port, and I played many of them, not all of them, that what Leon just described varies quite a lot.
Yeah.
So the sure. Spectrum version, the original Spectrum version, yes, we know, there's a later, we'll talk about in a bit, the original, no, not, yeah, no, not so great. The Amstrad version, there's more frames of animation, I found.
Okay.
A lot more frames of animation for the enemies. I really found that. The ninja especially. He's just really darting around and moving and stuff like that. So I really liked that. There's definitely, they put a little bit more effort because it was released later. And the BBC version, the less said about that, the better. And but yeah, for me, it's the core ones. I mean, the MSX version. Oh boy, the color palette. Brave decisions made. Almost like migraine inducing, I should say.
Wow.
And it doesn't. Yeah, it's a bit. It's not a Spectrum port like most MSX games were back in the day, so they did put in some effort, but it was actually more like an Amstrad looking game, except the palette was terrible and the sound effects were really good, actually really really good, very similar to the almost like the Atari original I found, but it's just the animation wasn't there at all, very very sort of like very reduced number of frames if ever needed possible, so yeah, everything varies. But I think if you want to rank them, which we don't really do here, but I think...
No, we don't.
You know, I think the C64 kind of like tops them.
Visually. Well. yeah, I mean, I grew up on the Atari version, so that is my partisan choice on that. I played some of the C64 one, and as with many C64 versus Atari things, I think, you could go either way, and that is very much a taste issue. And, you know, the collision detection was actually slightly different on some puzzles, which annoyed me, but that is like, well, I learned it this way kind of stuff. The other two I looked at, the Spectrum one, which we'll get to, the sort of improved version I played, and the Apple II and the DOS one, and you can miss those. Like, they're surprisingly... For machines without sprites, you know, any Apple II conversion of an Atari or C64 game is always, as you put it, brave. It plays fine, but it's hideous and you don't need to play it. The DOS one is surprisingly fluid, but there's this vertical striping that if you pause it at any point, it looks like a magic eye puzzle. It's like beyond unreadable. Yeah. It's like camouflaging itself. Yeah. Wow. It's kind of fascinating. And, you know, it's using... maybe three colors. But yeah, I would say, you know, the three I liked were the Atari, the Commodore 64, and the Spectrum RX, which was basically the same thing, but someone made the things different colors so you could tell them apart, as far as I could tell. But maybe, Chris, did you play both of those? Do you know if there's any other?
Yeah, so the only other versions that... I did play both versions. I loved the RX version. I loaded it. I played that on my Next. So that really, really sang there. I love that. But it plays exactly the same. They just took the graphics and go, we can do way better than this. So they did, because they have time. And of course, there is the fan-made 2015 game for the Sega Master System, which is an interesting port.
Yeah, yeah. There's a few fan C64 sequels that I poked at. I didn't play too much of, but it certainly seems like the kind of game where you could, you know, they could have a level constructor, I suppose, right? Like there's a lot you could do with this.
Yeah. There is, yeah.
Audio-wise, well, we've already heard Adam's description, which is, I would say, fairly accurate. We've also already heard Jesse's vocal recreation. I'm not sure there's much more to be said. The high-pitched chimes of lanterns and the low moaning of enemies and the sort of skitter and of Bruce's feet and the noise of various kind of traps. Bipping away. It's stuck with me because I, you know, it was a formative period in my life and I've played it so many times. I don't think people would think it was much to write home about now, but I found it effective and kind of, quietly atmospheric.
I think it's really what struck me about it, and regardless of version, even the Spectrum with its beep and clicking, very informative. That's a bit dry and dull, but it is. You know, when you your flying kick and it struck, especially on the Atari, really felt the contact with that. Really good stuff. It is somewhat silent in terms of a score, but when it comes to actually the sound effects, they were, informative.
Yeah, I mean, and given the time it came out, I would much rather them not attempt to do music than, for instance, play a loop of 8 notes of Hall of the Mountain King over and over for eternity. So, you know, and I think that is part of why it holds up for a modern audience is it is spare, right? That it's not trying to impress anyone. Yes. As you said, even in 1984, the graphics are not flashy or impressive. They're clear and they work well. And the animation on Bruce Lee is fluid, but not in a Karateka rotoscoping kind of way. He's smaller.
No.
But yeah, again, an interesting comparison between those two games and kind of equally good games in their own way, but what they're prioritizing is very different.
Moobar from our forum says, Bruce Lee, talking about gameplay as we will be, a perfect blend of platforming and simple beat-em-up moves. The Ninja and Yamo are incredibly dim opponents who add an unexpected amount of joy to the gameplay as you manipulate them into hazards. Kicking them in the face, sending them backwards into fire traps never gets old. Some of the levels lend themselves into glorious non-stop run and jumping. Unfortunately, the flick screen levels themselves are too short and too few in number. There's only about 20 screens. But it's ridiculously playable, and even the occasionally glitchy movement as Bruce hitches on the scenery becoming an integral part of your play. Yes, it's easy, and yes, it's short, but Bruce Lee will always be on my list of must-play C64 classics. So yeah, Bruce. Controlling Bruce. Mm. We often talk about games and their, you know, modern games with their deliciously responsive fluid controls. And I think if you were to, listener, to go and load up AntStream Arcade now or whatever and play this, you might find Bruce a little bit kind of slow and floaty and skittery and jittery. But I think, as you said, Jesse, your students do find that the basic gameplay holds up.
Yeah, you can. He's predictable, and the controls are tighter than something like Apple II, Prince of Persia, or Karateka, in terms of being responsive, and it's kind of generous, right? You can kick that green Yamo or Ninja from pretty far away. You know, you tend to kind of, at least on the Atari version, I did notice it being a little less generous on maybe the other ones, but you kind of tend to win those things that could go either way, I find. One thing Mooba, in their great description, did not mention is they can kick each other. So you don't even kick them in the face instead of the fire trap. You know, the Yamo can kick the Ninja into the fire trap for you, and that is delightful.
Absolutely. Stuff like that, I think, is more, even more than the fundamental platforming, jumping around, lantern collecting. That's what is the personality of this game.
Yeah.
The the relationship between your character and the two enemies, and the two enemies in each other. And there's a lot of stuff going on that was, that, well, actually remains unusual. You know, some games don't have the sort of the ability for enemies to interact with each other in interesting ways. And even though this is just three tiny little sprites that all look differently, the fact that they do have this physical interaction that is consequential to gameplay is, yeah, as he says, it never gets old.
I think the biggest difference, and I must confess, this just struck me. Contemporary platform games at the time, any enemy on the screen typically was, oh, you touch it, you die.
100%.
Touch it, you die. Yeah. Whereas these, oh, no, no, these are all part of the environment. These are things you can interact with and actually punch in the face. Actually punch in the face. And it's like, wow, really struck me. Like, what? That's probably why it was one of the most appealing
things. And run past. And just literally go, you know, if their timing was off. Again, this is a Souls game. I can't emphasize that enough.
Gotcha.
Just run past the enemies. Don't fight them. And
philosophically, very different to Manic Miner, which was all about these pixel-perfect avoidances of everything.
Yeah. Just not there. And then, sadly, though, up to jump.
Ducking makes you
Of course, yeah. Luckily, you can remap that if you're playing it on other systems, modern systems, whatever else. So, but yes, up to jump was completely normal and expected for home computer games at that point, and indeed for quite a few years after. It was only once we got into the console. that too.
Although
yeah.
even on the Apple II one, which, you know, the Apple II joystick had its was worse overall, but did have two buttons, and you do have that thing with some conversions like Choplifter or Load Runner having to or Karateka having to figure out how to go from two to one button. But yeah, I on the Bruce Lee there, it's still up to jump. I don't know, that second button just didn't do anything.
Oh, okay.
Maybe it was punch and kick, like in Karateka. I didn't notice that because I never punched. Oh, I only kicked.
Yeah, I mainly kick.
Did any of you actually play as Yama and?
Oh, yeah.
You can.
Yeah, I have.
I recruited a student. Yeah. I mean, as a child, I did this a lot.
Yeah.
So when you press down, he would yell. That was what I seem to remember. And I would do that just relentlessly. I found more entertaining than actually punching.
It is, hey, you're invading someone and doing an emote over and over. Wonder what game that reminds you of.
Just ridiculous game. So ahead of its time in so many different things. 84. Wow.
Really curious decision that Yamo sort of in the game is presented as he looks like he's supposed to be a sumo, but of course his moveset is absolutely not that of a sumo. Although did he invent E Honda from Street Fighter all those years later with his flying kicks and whatever.
To go back to what Adam said, I feel like one special thing about this game is everyone our age played it and thinks they're the only person who played it because no one ever wrote about it.
What is that?
You know, or like it's just there. And I don't know how I ended up with it either. Like I think it was on sale. There was a review in that collection of reviews of it in Britain in like 86 where it's like £1.99 and it, you know, gets 92% and that zap kind of like bargain bin of like,
that's
still
it.
Still holds up.
I don't remember how we got it. It's too long ago.
I'm
sorry. We had an original copy. It wasn't the, you know, but I just don't know.
I'm going to make a guess that in 85, it was re-released in America as like a $15 or $20 budget version. And that's when we all picked it up. And that's why it went back on the charts.
Yeah. That's that makes
speculation,
sense.
But yeah.
Yeah. I think I remember the review of the Americana cassette. $1.99 version, and actually it was apparently it was a $1.99 tape, which is which was common, but not for Americana. Americana generally released stuff at $2.99, so even they sort of acknowledged that it was, you know, old in some ways. But yeah, when it was re-reviewed by Zap, I remember that review and thinking, yeah, because I, you know, I still had that game and I was probably still playing it at that point, and thinking sort of I had no reference point as to what other people thought of this game until I saw that review, and then it was like, oh, Zap gave it a budget equivalent sizzler, and I, you know, I sort of felt vindicated in the fact that I'd played this game so much and so often. So I guess we should talk about, given that it is such a small game, we can kind of talk about how you get through it, starting at the top left of this map. you have to collect a number of lanterns. It even tells you in the manual, kind of, some of the screens you have to collect every lantern, and some of the screens you have to collect a number of lanterns or certain lanterns. And it starts off, above ground, working your way left to right. But quickly, you start to notice that you can drop into levels below. There's also a certain amount of climbing up and down, sort of meshing or webbing, or given the visuals, I was never entirely sure what they were supposed to be. But that does bring in one of the kind of the locomotion quirks, which again was mentioned by Mubar. I don't know how this translated across the different versions, because maybe they were smoothed over in some ways. But on the original Atari version, there was actually quite a glitchiness to Bruce's clambering and walking across uneven floors and things like this. But again, while it wasn't like, in some ways you'd think it was suboptimal and roughly coded or whatever, it actually sort of made it somehow more interesting, more textured, that he wasn't just this kind of, you know, utterly smooth, glidey kind of character. He had this kind of, he had to kind of work his way up these nets and meshes.
Yeah, I did found... One of my favourite things to do in the first three screens, because it's his first three screens, you can't do anything until you collect every lantern. And I always leave the one in the middle, on the right-hand side in the middle. I just leave that, because I knew I'd have to come back, and as soon as I get that, I just like seeing the door open at the bottom. Mm-hmm. It's a little thing. You don't have to do it. You can do
it. I get it.
But it's like, oh, I just drop down. It just feels like optimised play. It's like, you know, the precursor to... you know, speed play, like, or speed running, like, for that, pop in, and then as soon as I get, and also it means that the enemies don't pop and appear and annoy me as I'm leaving. It's like, no, I'm just gonna, you know, and it's just, yeah, tactics, everyone, it's there.
Well,
but yeah,
get more specifically to the enemies, but for people who haven't played this game, it's probably worth saying up front, like, what we're talking about is every time you go to a new screen, there's a pause for a few seconds, but it's always the same two enemies. There's not like specific, like, Goombas are on this screen. Like, I assume in Jet Set Willy or whatever, like, each screen has its own specific enemies. And there's at least six or seven of the 20 that don't have them appear and are just trap rooms. But, right, there's no other enemies in this game. Well, other than the boss, which will be anticlimactic.
Hold fire. Yeah, yeah. Don't talk about the boss yet.
No,
you can't spoil it.
No.
No, don't worry.
So once you've made your way across, as I say, there's some, I guess it looks like you are supposed to be in Tibet, Japan, I guess somewhere far eastern with mountains and kind of that sort of architecture. There's a famous, well, I say famous, it's famous to me, like a bull or a bison statue or something, a few rows along. I don't know what it's supposed to represent, but it looks like it's some kind of sacred animal.
Yeah.
In a temple. Then there's, some castle crenellation kind of turrets. But then, you know, that idea, that sort of feeling of mystery and going somewhere new underground is when you start sort of venturing into those levels beneath and sparks the imagination for those. We were all, you know, in our very youthful youth at this point when we were first playing this, and computer games were what they were then, and just venturing into this kind of blue-tinged, purplish underground was kind of intriguing in itself.
I like the change on, because this is just these regular lanterns, and most of them were static. Some were flashing. You had to pick them up when they were flashing, although not every version did that, by the way. But I think the Spectrum version doesn't do that. They're just static all the time. But then there would change. There's this bit where these three, like, what I call waterfalls. I don't think they are, but they look like waterfalls.
I think they are supposed to be waterfalls.
Yeah, they look like it.
Maybe.
But you can climb up them. I think that sense. But, all of a sudden the lanterns change shape to the point where in the C64 version, it's very difficult to see them. Like, encountered them, like, oh, what's that? Like, why can't I get through? And it was just difficult to see. And they're just, rather than the big glowing lantern things, they would almost look like something part of the scenery until I accidentally jumped onto one and then it did the bling. Oh, I meant to pick those up. But I love the fact that it changed in the form. And also you go back to the beginning of that. the beginning phase again. You find yourself back there again, and the hippo things are yelling for reasons best known to themselves.
That's right.
And
there's more than one, isn't there?
Yeah, there's two of them.
Right.
Either
but
end.
That opens up, and this is. I'm gonna keep hammering this, right? But
you look at Dark Souls,
and you look at that kind of spatial.
We're on brand.
And how satisfying that is! I really think this is the first game I played that did that thing of like, oh, everything you've done is just to open a secret where you started that leads to this crazy area, right?
Yeah,
and that sense of. And this is a very linear game, right? That's one thing we should say is it's one thing that makes it easier maybe than something like Zorro is that game is puzzlier, even Atari Adventure is more non-linear, right? This is Sen's Fortress. This is a, this is a series of tasks that are a lot of times like this thing will kill you if you don't jump at the right moment and people are trying to whack you at the same time and those things interact. That physical structure, it's just a remarkable game of how, like, it is a simple version of so many things I encountered later on. Like, I don't know if it's the first time I ever encountered this kind of timing puzzle, or you collect all this stuff and this opens up and you go back and you have to figure out. But yeah, it's remarkable level design, and it stuck with me surprisingly strongly, having not played it for ages, or at least the back half.
Beneath the moody and atmospheric purplish, bluish rooms, and again, I'm referring really to the original game here because A, it's the original, and B, it's the one I know, there are even more intimidating, furious-looking red rooms, which is where the challenge starts to ramp up with increasingly large numbers of spiky outcroppings, nasty kind of pillars of sand that drag you into the moor, and the first instances of the... I get this is a 40-year-old computer game, but even within that context, there's a lot of stuff in here that is quite hard to sort of think what were they actually trying to represent here with the light up spikes, whatever they are that zip across the floor and you have to time your run so you don't get zapped by them.
Yeah, that was very peculiar. I think heaven knows what they were supposed to be, but I did like them.
Yeah.
I found them very challenging to overcome, although the Amstrad version was not impossible.
Oh, really?
Blue room.
The blue room. There's okay, blue well, room. Let's talk about that. So adjacent, or nearby, you have to get to it elsewhere, but on the map, it's quite near the three red rooms, is the blue room.
Yeah.
The one and only kind of blue room in the game. There's a couple of other purple and lilac-y rooms, again, talking on the Atari version, but the blue room is the blue room. It has yin-yang symbols at the top in black and white, whereas elsewhere they're depicted in grey and white. And it is four layers of scrolling bumpy lines
in different patterns.
This is it, and this is probably the room that's like the skill check room in terms of platforming, because this is probably the place that you're most likely to come a cropper and get stuck if you haven't practiced. Yeah, was it? You did mention it on our pre-show chat, Chris. Was it particularly the Amstrad version, or was it just the room that was the bane of your life, no matter which version you played?
No, it is definitely the Amstrad version because there's a massive design change in the Amstrad version versus all the others.
The timing and everything.
No,
right.
Not the timing.
Okay.
Collision detection.
Mm.
Rather than a single little pixel,
yes,
it was four, a line of four.
Oh, nice.
For you to try and avoid that is way harder than a single pixel.
Do you think that was a deliberate thing to make the game more challenging?
Yes,
or just...
I don't think so. Okay. I think because it was a later version and they were tweaking it.
And it was different people working on different versions as well, for sure.
Their own interpretation. But one thing that always struck me every time I play through it, even to this day, is that the first three, you have a rest point.
Mm-hmm.
You drop down. And then the last two... I know, you got to time both of them at the same time because there's no no rest point. So he's like, "Oh, think you've got this? Not today. Look at that. There you've got to." I remember on the Spectrum version, I was just focusing like laser on each layer. Like, okay, when I got to the last two, I went, no. But I did it. It's fine because the Specky version is it's a lot more forgiving. Let's just say that. So yeah,
and it's interesting because I think you know it's the sort of level of challenge that these days would be considered fairly low wattage, especially, you know, if you compared it to something like, and here's another drink, Super Meat Boy. There's the actual individual moments of skill required in this are not, you know, they're probably not even up there with sort of later levels of a Mario game or something. But once you factor in the sort of the way in which Bruce's locomotion is, the way he floats through the air and all that sort of thing, it does get a little bit more challenging. Again, if we talked about this in terms of other games recently, Castlevania Rondo of Blood, like how much control you have over your character in the air and all that sort of thing, and these challenges are designed around that. And yeah, I certainly still have that feeling of when I arrive in that room, it's like, ah yeah, it's this room.
Just that you have a limited number of lives and you don't get to you know, that if you play it now, you can use save states or the cracked versions or what you might end up with anyway. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the Super Meat Boy, you just made me realize that like my literal memory of this game as a child is basically like after you complete a Super Meat Boy level and you see all your failed attempts and like it dwindle, you know, then there's just a little few guys going at the end there. And that is why I have such a better memory of all of the rooms before this room. Than all, you know, the rooms after this room. Because, you know, maybe I made it like a half dozen times. And it does astonish me that I even finished this game because, right, you don't get to practice. Mm. Like, you play through the entire game again, you nail that, and then you get to this room. And maybe you've got three times that you can, you know, try it or whatever until you do the whole game again.
There is also the orange room. I've just got to have to say this because it's really important. Right, this part, this is where you're going left and right, basically. You're climbing up ladders, going left, but it's going, all of a sudden, Load Runner sort of like doing the, going across a pole, sort of shimmying across a pole, like nowhere else in the game.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
do
yeah.
This. It's what's like, the, what's the, what's that?
Ultimate
oh, hang
room.
On.
The ultimate
yeah, it's just like, yeah. You just like, you just go, oh, well, I've not got to do this now. Doesn't tell you. Does not tell you. Just like, just figure it out. You've been doing this on ladders. I'm sure it'll be fine. But it's a challenging one. Not nearly as challenging as the. Quite frankly, it's a relaxation point compared to the previous rooms. But
also in the sort of second half of the game, and there literally are 18 playable screens, 19 including the boss, and then there's the treasure screen. The last few, you've got the waterfalls or whatever. I think that's pretty much what I used to call it. This is not a game, by the way, listener, where it used to give you like fancy or fanciful screen names. You just, you know, this is why we're scratching around trying to describe them.
The manual's like 2 pages.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But yes, there's a load of inside the castle. I think they're supposed to be grey rooms in the original game mainly. They've got these sort of curving climbable areas which were quite unusual for the time. More of the yin yang symbols. This is, there's a lot of run-ins with Ninja and Green Yamo at
this one, but you also get extra lives here, didn't you?
Extra lives indeed.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's nice.
A late little treat
right at the end. Like, what are those two gold things? Doesn't again.
Yeah,
never seen him anywhere else in the game.
Yeah weird.
It's just, it looks like another piece of the scenery. He's like, oh, I'm going to run over there because they're a different color. They're unique. I'll have a look. Oh, hang on. What's this?
Yeah.
It's just like,
very odd.
I think, it's very odd. It feels like the developer may be able to put, you know, words in their mouth. They probably thought, well, let's just give them something because they got this far.
Throw them a bone.
They got this far. Mm. Cheers.
Yeah. And then, I suppose after that, you've only got a couple of rooms, haven't you? Two or three, maybe. But obviously, yes, they have their challenges. And I suppose, if you were down to your last life, wiping the sweat from your brow, it was very welcome, and it gave you a chance of getting through the tricksiness of the last few screens before the final boss. I'm curious about this. So did they keep this the same in all the versions?
You
probably didn't get that far in all the versions.
I didn't, but
which is reasonable. I'm not calling you out on that.
No, I got to it in three versions. It's just not bad going.
Not bad at all.
So maybe four, because it's four. Four versions.
Okay. And does the strategy of the original game work in all those versions?
Yes.
That's what... Oh, good. Okay.
Basically, should we put the listeners at their misery?
Yeah, let's ruin it. I don't know how deliberate this was.
No.
Because I suspect the idea was that you, or at least the original concept, surely on paper, was that you had to do some dodging, right?
Yeah.
In the same way as, like, to get past a Bowser at the end of a Super Mario Brothers level, you either have to jump over him or jump under him or blop him with fireballs. Something. You have to do something. In this game, all you have to do is not let go of the joystick when you enter the room.
Just run.
That's literally it.
Just run. No, let's describe him. Him, them, don't know.
He's a big for the time, a screen filling boss.
Yes.
Terrifying.
Or like the one at the end of Spelunky.
Yep.
Right. Never seen it.
Yeah,
I mean, he's about a sixth of the size, but he's an imposing figure. Yes. He's meant to be this wizard. He's horned, demonic, purpley creature clinging onto these kind of bars, glaring down at you and shooting fireballs out of his mouth. Imagine the scenes when, you know, you were used to much smaller sprites in your games generally, and you'd played through 17 screens of this game, and all you'd come up against was, apart from spikes, two little guys, and then suddenly you got this screen filling guy. But as soon as you learned that all you have to do is just hold right, you have to run to the other side of the screen. That touches a switch, and he just explodes. Yeah, basically, it goes different colors.
That's it.
Very weird.
There goes your Dark Souls comparison.
No, that's Demon Souls, right?
Oh,
that's
okay.
the ending boss at the end of Demon Souls.
Okay,
that's,
fair enough.
That's his,
Miyazaki
fair, already took fair. From this once. He didn't want to repeat himself. I do have a quote here from the Retro Gamer article, so it's a relatively recent interview with 40er, but it says, asked if he would make any changes to Bruce Lee, Ron offers a single regret which doesn't dampen the pride he feels in his game. Pat Garcia was present, and he had problems playing the game, so he had me dial it back a bit. Given the choice, I would have gone with the second-to-last settings, as I felt they were perfect, but I built a game that I wanted to play. I was given the opportunity by Datasoft to craft the code and make it tight. That really paid off in the end. You know it's a great game when the team continues to play it after it ships. So
yeah.
I wonder if this is one
one
of those places where, it could have that feel. I mean, it might as well extend the Souls thing as far as possible, but there are those places in that game where you feel those last-minute changes of, like, the blowgun guys in Blighttown weren't meant to... They're not bosses. They shouldn't disappear after they die, but come on. Like, where they just, you know, break their own rule a little bit or whatever. But I do think he says a little earlier, every designer wants a varying level of difficulty in their games. You don't want someone to run through it, and you don't want to frustrate someone. The key for Bruce Lee was getting it dialed into the right rates. And I luckily had a development system that allowed me to assemble my code and test it rapidly. And I think it really is like Prince of Persia, or like these games where just the person has a sense of dramaturgy. Right, some sense of the up and downs of the arc. You beat this,
and it's also that there is a cinematography to the that sort of sense of the victory lap. You know, the why actually ruin somebody's experience by kind of just bawling them out at the end when you can actually give them the, because you know, why did I complete this game so many times? Why did Capone's sister play it through seven times in a row? Partly because. You knew once you got to the final boss, you were just going to flick a switch and end the game.
And see the cool victory screen, whatever that is.
Well, this is it.
Yes, come on.
Flashing treasure, which of course on the Atari version is a color cycling thing. The treasure is kind of, flashing gold and blue and all that. And again, I hope that they kept the treasure screen in every subsequent port and didn't skimp on. Because again, these two things, these two last screens, were not a given in computer games at this point in any sense. Like, to have a final boss, to have a reward screen, these things were not just, oh yeah, my game will definitely have this. The amount of times that a game just looped with nothing, no indication that you'd completed it, or you know, you might get a text with well done written in basic font on it, and then back you go. To have even there were also more elaborate end sequences and stuff than this, but it had a final boss, it had a congratulatory screen, and that for me was made it worth coming back to over and over again, as well as kicking ninjas into traps. Things like that. So they, in the other ones you completed, did they retain the treasure screen?
They do. Some are better than others.
Yes, sure, of course.
yeah, the Sega Master System. Whew, we'll talk about it later. But yeah. Out of all of them, it's really, really good. Just lovely reward. Although, you know, Bruce Lee, interesting in, you know, possessions. I don't know, you know, material.
Well, yeah. I mean, the story is, as we say, it's barely there. Yeah. It's definitely not an adaptation of one of his movies. He wasn't around to veto it. Presumably, his money, the license money, went to his estate, and they just, you know. And also, we were in an era where you had a computer game of a character or a license. There was a lot less kind of control as to what the content of that thing would be, or you know, you can depict someone doing this and you can't depict them doing that. So yeah, there's very little rhyme or reason to why he goes through this castle collecting these lanterns, presses a switch to an explode a wizard, and then gets rewarded with a pile of treasure.
Yeah, well, it does come off quite well, though, it's got to be said. So
there's a quote in the other the Electronic Games article, which is contemporary, right? Comes out when the game comes out, of like, you know, 40 years, saying, "We watched all the Bruce Lee movies as well as other martial arts films on videotape. We had this idea of utilizing really fantastic graphics to create a sort of computer movie with the player as a character." And, you know, they didn't go the rotoscoping route, but it feels like they really did care about Bruce Lee, but more from, right, the angle of, like, we want you to feel like Bruce Lee. And then when you watch the movies, I haven't seen many, but I did Fists of Fury is on Amazon, and I assume all the versions that they were able to watch would be dubbed. And the dubs are, of course, insane. Like, again, this sort of secondhand thing where I had seen Kentucky Fried Movie and its parody of the insane dubbing, and right. But like, I'd never seen the original. Yeah. And it is, there is a Brechtian distance. Like, you would not feel like you, like, it is, you have to stay inauthentic to really capture the feeling of these movies, because if you watch them in these, like, American videotape versions, Fist of Fury starts with, it is the war between, you know, Bruce Lee is in a Chinese martial arts school, a Japanese person comes in and basically goes, "Meh, I'm Japanese and you're Chinese, see? Like, we don't like you." And Bruce Lee responds like John Wayne, like, "I don't know about that." And you're just like, okay, this... Yeah, yeah, sure. The green sumo wrestler, no problem.
Yeah, why not?
Why not?
Probably invented Blanca as well as E. Honda, actually. Now I think about it. So this game is. I mean, it's one of those games that it's quick when you practice it and you know how to complete it. How long to beat has it as a 31-minute game? But that's snail's pace compared to the world records. So speedrun.com does have a Bruce Lee section, although it is only 8 entries long. 6 of them are Commodore 64 version emulated, and 2 of them are the Atari 8-bit version emulated. I assume, therefore, looking at the times, that maybe, given that the top 4 are all on the C64, maybe there are some little slight gameplay tweaks and differences that mean that it's possible to do it faster on the C64 conversion. The world record is by Impossimol, from Gremlin Graphics, and the time is 7:40:210, and that record was set 9 months ago, so people are still playing this game.
Nice.
For records,
I understand that the C64 version was worked on directly after the Atari, anecdotally, Jesse, you may correct me on this, but I think the developer did say he had a better time on the C64 version because of the certain custom chips and the and how it's using the processor differently to the Atari.
Yeah.
So he could do more with it. He could do more with it, basically.
That's interesting. I mean, Archer MacLean, RIP, always famously said that, what was it? His quote was something like, trying to code the Commodore 64 is like driving a three-wheeled roller skate compared to the Atari's Ferrari. But it depends what you're doing, I suppose, is the thing. Depends what you're trying to... And also the fact that he'd already made it once probably.
That is what makes these... those Commodore and Atari so specifically so interesting is because they do have these different strengths where in that Retro Gamer piece, he does say that like the game kind of started or like what the genesis of the gameplay quote was from research I was doing about the processors producing collision detection using the colors, which was a very specific thing to the Atari and is why I feel like the Atari probably has better collision detection. But the Commodore 64, when he brings it over there, right, he has more cycles to play with, and that version definitely feels snappier.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think if you're going to play this game, I would really recommend playing both of those and that Spectrum RX version and just deciding, like, they all have their strengths. They're all kind of interesting, and they're all pretty playable.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the various versions, or the ones we can anyway. I mean, we pretty much just covered off the Atari 8-bit and C64 versions there, I think. So of the other conversions, which ones did you manage to boot up, Chris O'Regan, in your den of science and magic?
My little personal museum of computers and consoles. So, yes, the Atari 8-bit, the C64 version, Spectrum, MSX, Amstrad, BBC... and Sega Master Systems, and Stream. So I did all of those because you know, and Stream is a platform, we can't deny it. So I had to go on all of those. And let's see. I think that there's something to be said that the effort spent on some of the later versions. There's the Spectrum RX, which we mentioned. It's like I said, exactly the same game, but all the sprites and sprite work, the graphic work completely replaced.
Fan games. Fan games. But this is available on...
like, done on the actual Spectrum. Like, they're not cheating, quote-unquote, where the graphics aren't right. They're just putting in more time on it.
Yeah, indeed, they have more time.
And it's a free download, I think, on it.
Yes, you can pay what you want.
So, the BBC version, I want to talk a little bit more. I didn't want to, but I'm going to have to, because...
Yeah, go on. I'm curious.
The ninja's not there.
It's like a buddy movie. It's like you can't have Bing Crosby without Bob Hope. What are you doing?
No, so I don't know where he's gone. Maybe he's just two stooges. Deal with it.
The one stooge in this game,
and Yamo. He's lost a lot of weight. He is green. Lost a lot of weight, and here's the shocking thing: he can climb and jump. And he chases after you.
Well, that actually could be interesting.
Yeah, it would be, wouldn't it? So he's terrified. Yeah. He's just relentless. He just wouldn't let
it's like the Terminator.
Yeah, he's just like, he can do what Bruce Lee can do. He can do all the same things. Bruce.
That's kind of cool, but also it's a massive liberty with the original game, isn't it? Like, you're converting this game, don't write your own.
Exactly. So, and then the biggest problem with the BBC version is... You know all the traps where they've got the sliding sort of like patterns going on platforms? If you drop through them, you could find yourself being, you know... all the timing is off on the BBC version. You need to do... It's split second. None of it works. It's
awesome.
Wow.
Just made it incredibly painfully difficult to the point where I don't want to play this game. It's just... They've taken the premise of it and go, oh, I can make this better. Please don't. But they
and I realise in most cases, when we speak to our listener about things like this, we're preaching to the choir. But again, if you were not around in the early / mid 80s playing games, this was to have a version of a game that already existed that was fundamentally, you could draw unkind comparisons with sort of downgraded Switch ports and stuff, but fundamentally those games tend to still work. Whereas here you're not getting a kind of stripped back version. You would be getting a completely different set of code and graphics made by completely different people, oftentimes very quickly. And sometimes they just don't even function.
But Yeah, go on, Jesse.
No, just I was thinking with Paradroid and Quasitron on the Spectrum. Oh, where they just like were like, well, we can't do the vertical scrolling, so we'll make it a and like that occasionally works. But and I do wonder what technical I assume the BBC microconverter was like, well, there's no way to have a second sprite. So I guess we'll make the Yamo
possibly
svelte and athletic.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very, very strange, but yeah.
Something like that will have gone on. Absolutely. Yeah. Or I possibly the coder says, I can't work out how to get a second head because I'm sure some programmers definitely will have done.
The last version I want to talk about, if I may, is definitely going to talk about the Sega Master System, which came out in 2015.
Another fan version.
A great fan version. It visually the best. Of course, it's got all the power of the Sega Master System thrown at it. Wonderful visuals, wonderful sound, music. It's all there. The biggest change they did, right? The biggest. It's a subtle one and a nice one. And it would have been love to have had it in the other games, but you have to. You basically have to check it yourself. So you know when you're in combat, and when you combat, you do a flying kick to the ninja, he'll die twice. If you hit him twice with a flying kick, and yet Yamo, he will take three flying kicks to removed, give or take. That's what I found, generally speaking. Well, in the Sega Master System version, you have a life bar, an energy bar.
Right.
So it will tell you how much you've been hit to see how many you can take. A nice little quality of life sort of information thing. But it plays very well. In fact, a little bit too well because it's a more powerful machine. You can do more things. Sure. The collision detection is incredible. There's no flickering. It's just absolutely really extraordinary. But it's much, much easier because of it. There's no ambiguity. You know exactly what platforms are, what you can stand on. The visuals are so obvious. You can say, now I know what that is. You know, and it's just, it's all, wonderful stuff. It's really, if you can have a go and ferret it out somehow, do check it out. But it's for what I did, it doesn't loop. once you're done, it's going, game over. Like, what? Yeah, so you've got to optimize your score with one play session. Okay. So that's an interesting take. That's but cool. I'm happy that it exists. I'm happy that I could play it.
Yeah, I've now downloaded it. It was 51K, so hopefully that did not disrupt Skype. but yeah, I mean, just looking at the graphics, it looks awesome. I guess we're getting to gameplay. And right, the one beef some of my students did have is you don't know when Bruce Lee is about to die, right? That he takes some indeterminate number of hits himself.
Yes.
And what's odd is that this game is both very clear in general and, again, has good dramaturgy in terms of, like, excitement. Mm. And it is weird to, like, not even a health bar, but, like, Bruce Lee starts flashing if he can only take one more hit type of thing. It is interesting that It's kind of anticlimactic. You get hit again and, okay, player one. I guess that was the one that killed me.
Yeah, very much so. But you kind of get, you get a feel for it, which is...
I'm not sure if it resets between screens. I think it does, but I don't know. I'm not sure if your health resets. I think it does.
I'm not sure. Yeah, that's the kind of murkiness that is a little...
You can tell.
Incongruous, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to, I want to say this again, just in case people missed it and because it's the kind of thing you could easily gloss over listening to a Kane & Rince podcast. If you do want to play the original or at least the first conversion thereof, the Commodore 64 version, it is available right now in your browser officially on AntStream Arcade. You can also download the client for your Xbox, although you have to pay a fee. It's just called Lee. So search Lee and you'll find it. There's only the C64 version on there, which is disappointing because they do often have multiple versions of games, but in some cases they don't. And right now they only have Lee on there. But yes, look for Lee. Don't look for Bruce Lee. You won't find anything. But that's possibly the most accessible way to play the original or the closest thing to the original right now. And as I say, that's also what they're calling the 400 mini version, which isn't out yet. So Bruce Lee RX is by Hi-Riser. That's the version for the Spectrum on itch.io. There were a couple of other games released as, again, like, I guess you could almost call them, I mean, they are sequels. They're all new levels with all new graphics. In 2015, Bruce Lee 2, which is listed as a public domain game, unofficial port of an unofficial sequel. It was originally released actually for Windows and Linux in 2013. It's enhanced on the Commodore 128 even. And yeah, it's more Bruce Lee, very much with the art style retained from the original game. And then 4 years after that, a similar kind of looking game is Bruce Lee Return of Fury from Mega Style. And again, I can only assume it was, although it's not listed where I'm looking as public domain, it's another fan project clearly. Although it does have a very nicely drawn new Commodore 64 slash loading screen of the man himself. So yeah, the fandom lives on. One other, which was actually a little older, and I'm not sure I'm particularly fond of what they've done with the graphics, but Ultimate Bruce Lee came out in 2008 for Windows, and I don't think it even goes beyond the first level or the first set of rooms, but it has totally kind of revised. I wouldn't call them 2000 style graphics. I call them 90s style graphics, even though the game's from the 2000s. But it also looks like you can flip possibly to Spectrum and Commodore 64 looking graphics as well. Anyway, that one's Ultimate Bruce Lee. I'm sure you can find it out there somewhere. Cats and Cucumbers posted on X or Twitter. And I wanted to read this before we go into the three-word reviews because it's pertinent to the first one of those. So Cats and Cucumbers says, Bruce Lee was a very early gaming memory for me. My dad and I used to play it together, and I remember how proud we were when we beat it. We didn't play together that much later, but this game is an abiding memory of my childhood and spending time with me dad. Which takes us into...
Yes, first one from Cats and Cucumbers. Dad and I.
From Catnap 92, get those lanterns.
Cantona's Ghost says, game of death.
It's Hazel says, fighting for immortality.
Lindy Bailey says, big green fellas.
One Credit Classics, Ben says, just run right.
Jason Ho, patrons, man, myth, legend.
There we go. Bruce Lee, then. Just need to wrap up and summarize a relatively brief show for a relatively brief game. But it's been a lot of fun. I'll go first. This game is stands out as being one of the few games from the 8-bit era. It wasn't the only one, but there were only a handful that I would play knowing that I could beat, finish, kill an end boss, see an end screen, and just have a thoroughly good time doing so. The comment that tricking the enemies into fighting each other or pushing them into traps never got old. I think that's the real kind of spark this game has that lifts it above just being another kind of flick screen arcade adventure or platformer or beat 'em up. It's a bit of all of those things. The fact that it's Bruce Lee is almost neither here nor there, although it gives them the license for a sort of a slightly curious, fantastical setup and scenario, which is all but by the by, really. Yeah, as Catnap 92 says, get those lanterns. And yeah, if you want to kind of find out, I don't know how educational this game is in terms of like what else was around at the time. It was certainly formative in some respects, but in others, I think it was kind of ahead of its time and quite innovative. But yes, I do think, you know, playing it now on Antstream or whatever, it still retains some fun. But it's hard for me to be in any way objective about that because I played this when I was in my youth, my childhood as a child that was kind of totally bewitched by computer games. So it's a recommendation from me, but as much as anything to kind of as a bit of a history lesson, which is hopefully what we've done in this here podcast. Let's go, Chris.
You quote Mr. Pone Adams. He's right. It's a weird game, but that's not to detract from how much fun it is. It sounds a bit shallow, but that's what it is. It's a very well put together, condensed 30 minutes of fun. And you can be successful at it, depending on what version you're playing. But generally, you can make significant progress. Whereas most of the games of this era, you know, it takes days, a week sometimes to get through the most rudimentary components of it. But this doesn't do that. Bruce Lee doesn't do that. It really is respectful for the player's time and really, rewards them for just a little bit of perseverance. And it's just a joy to play. There's nothing wrong with that. And that's why it stands the test of time, why people are still playing it 40 years later, because it's fun and it's really well put together. And the fact that you have bits of it, these advances and sort of hints at what is to come in video games all those years ago, it can only be celebrated for that. Oh, yeah. Just don't play the BBC version.
That's probably not going to be too tough an ask for most of our listenership, although you never know. And let's wrap up with Jesse, who's going to tell us why it's Dark Souls Zero.
It's the original Souls game. I stand by this. And I have other comparison points that I will bring up. But I do the one thing that I want to emphasize and in my little bullet points for my class slide, the first two are, most successful of DataSoft's license of action platformers, bullet point two, collect the lamp, da-da-da. Bullet point three, two-player hot seat mode allows second player to control the green Yamo and is the greatest innovation in the history of computer games. Now, do I literally mean that? Maybe not. But in terms of things that I encountered that are pure game design, right, that are, there's obviously a technical element, but as he says in one of those interviews, it was kind of come across by accident that, well, we wanted to see, we didn't have the AI yet, so we let them control, and hey, it was fun. But let me tell a short anecdote. We've got a half hour still. The first time that I ever took money out of an ATM, back when you could get $10 out of an ATM, I got, pushed a little button for 10, and I got two $10 bills stuck together. And that has ruined me for every single time I've gone to an ATM in the last 35 years since. In a similar way, Bruce Lee's two-player hot seat mode has ruined every platformer that's come since, where I'm like, well, why can't the second player harass me? And again, until the Souls games. Then I finally felt like I was home. The green Yamo, and I've never, I'm now going to do a Souls build as the green Yamo, I realize. And I'm going to invade people and taunt over and over.
To create a character in Tekken as well.
Yeah.
But that idea. And also, I think I have realized guiltily over the course of this episode, I was looking at the instructions. If you play versus the green Yamo mode, you get 10 lives instead of 5 lives. And you can do that as one player and just let the green Yamo sit there because there is no second player, which, much like the Drake sword, it will get you through the first half of the game, but then you're not going to have the skills when you hit the parts where the green Yamo is not the problem. Also, ducking makes you invulnerable. So that's another, that really, and you get relatively few points for killing, when you kill the Yamo or the ninja, they come back 5 or 10 seconds later and you get like a tenth the points you get for going into a new room. So the incentivizing is, look, killing these guys is a means to an end. Farming them isn't the point. Like, if you duck and let them hit each other and just get out of the way and keep going, that is probably the best solution. And again, there's something weirdly prescient about all of this that I can't recommend playing this game more highly for people who normally don't play retro, especially computer games as opposed to console games, just because, again, you know, this is one of those every week there'd be something like Space Taxi or this or Hex or whatever, where it's like, you'll have a good time. And this, yeah, even if you're 20 years old and coming to this, you know, completely fresh, I think you'll get it. And definitely have a friend do the hot seat mode with you, because it will be hilarious and you'll have a great time.
Perfect. Just remains for me, Leon, to thank Chris and Jesse and our editor, Jay, all of our correspondents for remembering this pretty elderly game. And of course, to you for listening. Now, next time, in issue 609, our podcast has five endings as we cover Near Replicant version 1.22474487139. We'll be right back.